T.K. Whittaker is credited with pulling the Irish economy out of the doldrums in the 1950s. He later became governor of the central bank, and in 2001, the then 85-year-old former civil servant outpolled historical icons, politicians and celebrities to be voted Irishman of the 20th century by Irish TV viewers. Born in 1916... he died at the age of 100 in 2017, a life that spanned the history of the Irish state, making unprecedented contributions to the evolution of that state. As we'll hear, many aspects of his life and work have particular resonance for Ireland and for indeed the world today. I'm joined now by Whittaker's biographer, Anne Chambers. Her book, T.K. Whittaker, Irishman of the 20th Century, was recently republished by Red Stripe Press. And you're very welcome back to the History Show.
Pleasure.
One of the striking things is you mention one of his earliest memories, and this, I think, puts into perspective the span of the man's life, goes back to an image from Drogheda and the Civil War.
Yes, he told me that as a young boy in his family home in Drogheda, he was about 5 years of age, and he saw from his bedroom window Free State soldiers chasing a Republican with guns drawn. And that image, he said, stayed with him throughout his lifetime and really affected his future then policy behind the scenes, which he played in the search for a constitutional remedy for the crisis that was then ongoing in Northern Ireland. But that image, as a biographer, to me, that meant so much. And I could see how that image impacted on Ken Whittaker's lifetime to try and achieve peace by constitutional means in Northern Ireland, which happily he lived to see.
Tell us more about that, the title Irishman of the 20th century, inspired by that television poll, the background to it. I certainly voted for him, I know that. Not Dev, not Michael Collins, T.K. Whittaker. Well, why do you think so many people voted for this man that they would never have met and who was somebody who liked to be in the shadows?
Well, if a similar poll was held in any other country in the world, as you say, some so-called celebrity footballer or celebrity chef, I don't know, or even politician might have been elected, that the Irish people choose a former public servant as their Irishman of the century has been reinforced for me since the launch of the book. The first edition was, of course, in 2014. And he was happily alive and the new edition came out just before Christmas. But I see that replicated myself when I give talks on Whittaker around the country. Invariably, somebody comes up to me, as they did out in Black Rock there recently, and said to me, without this man, myself and my family would be citizens of another country because I'd been forced to immigrate in the 1960s. And when I was actually interviewing Ken Whittaker for the book, we used to take a break every day and we'd go to a local hostelry where we'd have lunch. And we'd sit down at a table and I'd look around the dining area of the pub and say, who's it going to be today? Because invariably, somebody would get up, a complete stranger, come up, apologise for intruding, which indeed they weren't, and would say to Ken Whittaker, I just wanted to shake your hand. Now, what politician that we know of would ever have received? So that confirmed to me again that the Irish people would have selected him.
He was hugely important in the role that he played in shifting Ireland from De Valera's protectionism to Lamassa's free trade in the 1950s, arguing that economic openness was the key to growth and prosperity. In contrast, we are probably now going to see a resurgence of protectionist policies worldwide, starting with Trump in the USA. Mm. How do you think Ken Whittaker would view protectionist trends and what lessons from his approach back in the 50s and 60s in Ireland might still be relevant today?
Well, as you know, it was Lamassa who introduced protectionism in the 1940s, and it was okay then. But by the mid-1950s, when Whittaker took over as one of the youngest, indeed, heads of the Department of Finance in the 1950s, when he took over there, he told me himself that protectionism had by then passed its sell-by date, that it had really by then was really introducing a period of economic stagnation as well as an atmosphere, he told me, of national despondency. You know, people had no hope in Ireland during the 1950s. There were 60,000 people immigrating yearly from Ireland, all the best, the young people were all leaving. And protectionism, he felt, was catering for that because there were tariffs on any foreign imports and particularly from Britain. And he told me himself, you know, that it was like very difficult to dismantle protectionism because it was felt by these former veterans, you know, of the Civil War, the War of Independence, 1916 Rising, La Masse de Valera. It was like letting Britain in again, so to speak. So all of that had to be got over. But you were so correct when you say that La Masse himself was beginning to turn away from the protectionism that he... So they made a great team. And Whittaker then came together quietly with a team of young acolytes in the civil service without anybody asking them to do it on their own time. At weekends, they came together and he formulated the famous document Economic Development, which I suppose has acquired the status of some Magna Carta now in Irish historical...
And we all get the name wrong. We all call it the Programme for economic Expansion.
No, that came from Economic Development, the first programme for Mac, and it changed and transformed the country. You know, and it, to the day he died, really, he really looked back in a very positive way on that. And the thing that really got to him was that it was adopted by the government of La Masse and De Valera almost overnight. They were so desperate.
But timing is everything. Was he fortunate in that more of his time, more of his productive time was spent with La Masse in charge than with De Valera?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. The only thing De Valera was, he said, economics really went over De Valera's head.
Even though he was a mathematician.
Exactly. That's often surprised me. But Whittaker said that it was all about the Irish language, you know, the preservation of the Irish language, which of course was important, but not at the expense of economic development. And you're so right when you see what we're faced today. History has that, as you know so well, Miles, the implacable way of repeating itself. And now we're faced again with trade tariffs and protectionism, which are going to affect this country, as we all know now, if Trump will possibly take him time to enforce his threat to the multinationals here in Ireland. And that is a big, big consideration. So I think another aspect of that would be the government's rainy day fund, you know, that people are looking to see spent in ways that are not maybe conducive now in view of what is happening. I'm sure Whittaker would have wished that the government keep that rainy day fund and indeed add the 14 billion that came from multinational tax to that, because it looks like we're going to need it down the way. And he was always looking ahead.
He was the quintessential public servant. Now, obviously, we're seeing tensions around the role of public service and public servants with debates over their independence, their political influence, their job security. Given his legacy, what do you think he would say about the victimization, basically, of public servants today, mostly in the US or egregiously in the US, but also elsewhere?
I'd say he would be absolutely shocked. He held, as indeed did his political masters at the time, all of them held the civil servants in regard. Whittaker always said, you know, that he had a great association with politicians and he felt for them in many ways. He said, you know, as a public servant, I can advise and I'm lucky if I get 50% of what I advise. And I understand that because the politician has to sell it at the doorstep at elections. And we all don't want to see cutbacks and we want everything to be good and dandy in the economy. But sadly, it isn't like that. And the politicians have to make, and he had great empathy and indeed sympathy for politicians. But I think for what's happening in America, he would be absolutely, as most reasonable people would be, it would be really something that he couldn't contemplate, really.
Now, he was a northerner, although he didn't live. You know, he moved at a very early age from County down to Drogheda. What part did he play in bringing peace to Northern Ireland, do you think?
Well, this was quite extraordinary. What I found in his papers, which I was given access to for the biography, he spent 30 years behind the scenes negotiating with people in the UK and Northern Ireland, people in the areas that he was most associated in economics, in finance, and to a lesser degree in the political field, which he left to the politicians. And he never did it, as he said himself, without the go-ahead of the incoming or the then government. He never went off on his own bat. He was a really a good citizen in that kind of way. But what he did was quite extraordinary and did affect policy documents both from the UK and from the Irish government over the years. And I have to tell you that one document I found in his collection called Northern Ireland, a Possible Solution, was the Good Friday Agreement for Slow Learners. It was written in 1971 with almost 5,000 deaths and the destruction and the alienation that occurred over the succeeding 30 years. And indeed, he said to a civil service counterpart up in the Northern Ireland, you know, if the North of Ireland had been left to us public servants, we would have done a deal much sooner.
He also gave recommendations on Ireland's neutrality and its role in European security during the 1992 Maastricht Treaty debate. Given today's discussions, I mean, it's very, very live topic all over again on NATO, EU defence, Ireland's position in this global security landscape. How relevant do you think his views are now?
Well, I think they've become very, very relevant. They possibly weren't when he made them in 1992. But, you know, while he was in total agreement with Ireland remaining neutral, he said Ireland needed to be in a position to defend itself against external aggression. And given its connection and dependence then and now on Europe, he also suggested, and I quote, that Ireland should be prepared to participate in some reasonable fashion in safeguarding the security of the European Union. You know, and he didn't mean it, as I say, by joining a military alliance, but to accept responsibility not only for defending itself against any anti-EU aggression, but also to cooperate with the EU by preventing Ireland, for example, for becoming a base for attack on another European nation. Now, all of this is like science fiction in the past, but it's very relevant today in view of what is happening in Europe, all over Europe, and certainly in view of what happened with Ukraine.
There is an award called after him, the T.K. Whittaker Award for Outstanding Contribution to Public Life, and it's awarded at the Business and Finance Awards each year. Who won it in 2022?
Well, quite extraordinary. Mr. Zelensky from Ukraine was the winner of the T.K. Whittaker Award. And in his acceptance speech, Zelensky referred to what Ken Whittaker had done for Ireland in the 1950s and 60s, which resulted in Ireland, and Zelensky said, living in Europe in peace and stability, which was now the aim of his own country.
Now, the only time I think I ever recall interviewing him and having the privilege to interview him was in connection with, it was a few years after the compilation of his prison reform report. That was came out in 1984. And that, I mean, it was a huge contribution, landmark document that addressed issues within Ireland's penal system and proposed significant reforms, most of which I think have been unfortunately largely ignored. How do the recommendations, do you think, hold up 40 odd years later?
Oh, it was really, it was the Reform of the Penal System report, and the prisoners' rights organisation of that period described Whittaker's report as, and I quote, a comprehensive, enlightened and caring document. And in it he made some quite amazing recommendations. But, you know, there's everything about Whittaker, there was a practical application to it. You know, he was looking at the cost, for example, of keeping prisoners in prison. In 1984, it was around 30,000 punts at the time. He looked at it from that kind of point of view. And he wanted to, he firstly said that there should be an alternative to prison. And this should be from confiscation of assets illegally acquired. Hence, the cab came out of that. Then you had, he said, community service instead of prison sentence for more minor crimes, which made practical sense. You had the education to be introduced into prisons because people perhaps who were in prison were there for maybe lack of education, and also you had for psychological treatment. He also suggested, which was accepted, that the day-to-day running of the prison system should be transferred from the Department of Justice to individual prison authorities, and partly that was implemented. And he also advocated the establishment of a female prison, which of course happened in Limerick. But a lot of his other suggestions sadly were shelved. But it's, that report is still there and it might be well worth re-looking at again.
You mentioned De Valera and the emphasis that he placed on the Irish language, and that's something that Ken Whittaker would have been very much in sympathy with. How do you think he would feel about the current status of the Irish language?
Well, towards the end of his life, he said he was at least happy that the Irish language has survived. But he did make the very, very valiant point, and that was that it was no longer government policy alone would suffice to keep the language going. It was up to all of us. We had to row in there. No use government legislation or anything like that. I think it's the people of Ireland who will keep the language going. And if we all did our little bit, indeed, I think he was most disappointed with me that I couldn't conduct an interview with him in Irish. My Irish had fallen by the wayside, and it was one thing that he commented on in our 60 hours of interviews. And, you know, it is a shame, and I've tried to do, you know, a little bit myself in that, and I think it's up to all of us to keep the language there.
How would you contrast the attitude to public service of Whittaker and his generation compared to the present day?
Oh, it's totally different. Ken Whittaker's political masters, you know, had fought for Irish freedom. And Whittaker, not just Whittaker, but his generation also, there were others in the public service who also had the same outlook. And they felt equally obliged to work for Ireland. You know, economic development was done, as I said, on a totally voluntary basis. There were no recompense from promotion, from top-ups, from bonuses. It was done by a group of young civil servants. Why? Because it was needed to be done for the betterment of the country. Now, say that to somebody today, and I think they would find that, let's say, anachronistic.
Well, there are many, many lessons to be learned from Whittaker's long life and contribution to society. We've heard many of the modern resonances there from Anne. We'll leave it there. The book is called T.K. Whittaker, Irishman of the 20th Century, recently republished by Red Stripe Press. The author is my guest, Anne Chambers. Anne, many thanks for joining us.
Pleasure.